Murder Monday. It's brand new for 2019. As a matter of fact, guys, we got a brand new open. You ready for this to go into your ear holes?
Yes, you have to tell us what you think of our brand new Murder Monday opener. Tweet us at Joe and Alex Show.
Police searched Gacy's home and found the decomposed remains of three bodies in a dirt crawl space under the house.
Tomorrow marks 30 years since Johnny Gosch disappeared on his paper route.
I just killed my mom and my sister.
The city is preoccupied with the killer, who in one note signed himself the Son of Sam.
The East Area Rapist, just when you thought the story couldn't get any worse.
Wrists and ankles chained, gagged, probably blindfolded.
We have an individual who apparently has the uncontrollable desire to kill.
It's Murder Monday on the Joe and Alex Show. Listener discretion is advised.
The reason we do Murder Monday is to bring attention to Crime Stoppers. They let you anonymously give tips. Call this number, 800-22-TIPS. Make sure you never miss a Murder Monday episode, by the way, by subscribing to our podcast, The Joe and Alex Show. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and more. Pretty much anywhere you can get a podcast. Make sure you give us a 5-star review, too. That helps us so other people can see it, and that way they'll know about it. If you love Murder Monday and the show, it's really going to help us out, so we'd appreciate that.
I actually heard this story for the first time the other day when a different podcast covered it, and I was completely mesmerized by the details of this case, which was told on this podcast by the main FBI profiler on the case. So what was cool about it was I got to hear details from him during his storytelling that you can't find online.
Mm-hmm.
And this story sounds like a Lifetime movie, but it's real life. So I knew I wanted to talk to you about it for Murder Monday. It's the murder of 7-year-old Danielle Van Dam. Danielle's story begins on February 1st, 2002, just outside of San Diego in Sabre Springs, California. Police get a call about a missing 7-year-old girl. Her parents wake up in the morning and start making breakfast, and when they call out to her to come downstairs to eat, that's when they realize there's no answer. Danielle's parents go upstairs to find her missing from her bed, vanished in the middle of the night. Danielle and her parents live in an upper-class, fairly wealthy neighborhood. They're tucked in pretty far off the main road, which FBI investigators notice right away because there's one way in and one way out of this neighborhood. And in order to get to her house, you have to take like 9 to 11 turns off the main road.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
Right. So this means it's highly unlikely that Danielle was taken by a stranger. And these are the types of things I always find interesting when discussing cases that you learn from talking to investigators and police is like the little clues like this.
Why is it highly unlikely?
Because if you are a random stranger predator, you're going to want this to be like your easiest abduction
possible.
Oh, in
and out? Okay.
Yeah, and you're going to pick a house that's like right there off the road. Like you're going to develop a liking for a child that you want to take.
But what if you really want that child though? What if you really you're obsessed with
it? I guess, but like what I'm saying is it's somebody that you have easy access to seeing all the time. So mm-hmm. if her house is tucked in 9 to 11 turns deep into the neighborhood, it's not easy for an abductor to like notice her. You know what I mean?
I'd hate to deliver a pizza there. I'd get lost.
So the investigators immediately know whoever took Danielle either knows her family and is comfortable with the location because they're friends with her parents, or the suspect is living right there in the subdivision. So now the FBI starts asking about Danielle's routine and her habits. What time does she go to school? Does she go to school in the neighborhood? Does she play outside? When she plays outside, where does she play? Front yard, street, backyard? And they find out she usually plays in her backyard with her brothers, and her parents are either with them or they're watching, and that there is a 6-foot wall in the backyard surrounding the house. So it seems like we've got an upper middle class, extremely low risk victim. But actually, the parents are living a pretty high-risk lifestyle. So first of all, child abductions are incredibly rare. When they do happen, parents are always the first people you look at because of the access they have to the child.
Mm-hmm, direct.
And the pressure is building on these investigators so rapidly because in a child abduction case, 44% of kids are killed in the first hour that they're taken, 73% are killed in the first 3 hours, and 99% of kids are killed in the first 24 hours of being taken. So as police are questioning Danielle's dad, they find out some pretty shocking information, and make sure you're following along closely because every detail of this case is vital. Daniel's dad says he woke up in the middle of the night or very early in the morning because their dog had started whining in the living room. So he walks down the stairs, and that's when he says he notices that the sliding glass door is open 6 to 9 inches. So he's thinking, okay, who the heck left this open? But he doesn't really dwell on it too much because they do have an alarm system that never went off. So he's thinking, okay, my wife or one of the kids had disarmed the house or something, opened the door and left it open on accident. So he lets the dog out to go to the bathroom and then closes the sliding glass door and goes back to bed. Another important piece of information is that this dog of theirs is a designer dog. They had its voice box removed so that it couldn't bark and aggravate the neighbors, which sucks because if you wonder, I mean, it makes you wonder, like, if this dog could have barked,
you would have heard it and you'd be like, wait a minute, what's going on?
Would the parents have woken up sooner? And remember this dog, because he's going to be, or she is going to be, an important part later in the story. So investigators polygraph the parents. They interview Daniel's two older brothers. Everything is checking out. Their stories match up. But they find out that the parents have a unique marriage, if you will.
What do you mean unique?
They're swingers.
Oh.
Which basically means they have an open relationship where they have other people come over and they hook up with these other people together or sometimes separately, which is very interesting to investigators because the parents, even just engaging in this type of lifestyle, immediately puts their children at a high risk because you've got strangers coming in and out of your house all the time. And those strangers happen to be sexually adventurous, which begs the question, was someone coming over to have relations with the parents who is also interested in children? They find out that the father was home the night Danielle disappeared with all the kids, and the mom went out to a bar with a bunch of friends and brought some of those friends home. One woman goes upstairs and gets into bed with Danielle's dad, while Danielle's mom stays downstairs with the other people, and they smoked pot. So her parents also smoked weed a lot, investigators find out, which again, more details about a risky environment for kids to be in, right? Investigators look into all the people that had been in the house that night, and nothing seems to be popping up. They go outside, kind of for a breath of fresh air, dealing with this case, and they take another look at the walled-in backyard, and they notice that there are neighbors on either side of the house, and they have three neighbors in the back that had views into the backyard, which makes it easy for someone to watch Danielle playing outside and start to develop fantasies about her. Well, four out of the five neighbors are home. The police interview them, they pass. But one male neighbor named David Westerfield is not home. And investigators immediately put a big star next to his name because that's weird. There's a child missing and then you're missing. Seems sketch, but okay. So they start asking other neighbors about this David dude. And they say that early that morning, he pulled this giant 40-foot RV into his driveway that he owns. Apparently, he's got two kids of his own, a boy and a girl who are older teenagers. He's divorced. And so these kids like spend some time with their mom and some time with him. And they go out to the desert all the time with like four-wheelers and like hang out and stuff.
Sounds like Breaking Bad or something.
Right. So, and they've also got a close relationship and everything sounds good there. Like, it doesn't seem like he's like a weird dad or anything. But it is strange that on a Monday morning and the morning after this girl goes missing, he loads up this stuff and leaves. And one neighbor says, what's weird is this guy is meticulous. He cuts his grass every week at the same time. He always puts things away and has a place for everything. But this morning, he fills up his water tank in the RV with his hose, and instead of putting the hose away, he leaves it out just sprawled across the front lawn and takes off.
Like what, maybe he was in a hurry or something?
In a hurry. It's also abnormal behavior for this guy. If you know, he's a super meticulous, clean, neat freak, organized guy, and for him to do something like that on the morning a girl's missing seems weird. So these are all little things that police notice. Has somebody had a change in their behavior? Did they change their appearance? Did they shave their beard off they've had for 10 years? You know, these are things that police want to know when it comes to like a kidnapping. So police try to contact this guy, but he's totally unreachable. They do talk to his kids and his ex-wife, and they don't hear anything fishy, but they still obviously want to talk to him themselves to see what he has to say. So the FBI puts out an APB on his RV and tells local police, as soon as this guy gets home, let us know because we want to talk to him. As they're waiting for David to get home, the FBI sits Danielle's parents down separately and asks them some questions. What they find out puts neighbor David Westerfield immediately on the map as their top suspect. While they're waiting on him to get home so they can talk to him, they sit the parents down separately for another interview, which they do that because just in case one or both of them are involved, it helps to compare their interviews against each other.
Like, what's their story?
Right, exactly. So if they are, you know, canoodling together or conspiring because they have something to do with their daughter's murder, it's easy for them to keep a straight story when they're together. So that's why they separate them for this other interview. And the FBI starts to ask more about Danielle and her exposure to people like outside of their family. And the mom says, well, last week I took Danielle around our block to sell Girl Scout cookies. We went into a couple homes and nothing really strange happened. until we got to the last house, which is the house right next door to us. The house she's talking about is the one belonging to David Westerfield, the missing neighbor. She says this guy opens the door, invites us in his house to buy Girl Scout cookies, and says to me, "Hey, it was great seeing you at the bar last week. Are you going to be out again this weekend?" Well, the backstory is the weekend before, this mom went out to do her swinger thing, and this guy David was there at the same bar and offered to buy her and her friends all a round of drinks. So they take the drinks, and David wants to dance with the mom, and she just kind of like walks away, leaving him hanging. So now they're standing in this dude's entryway, and Danielle's mom is like, "Oh no, my husband's taking the boys skiing this weekend in the mountains. I'm going to be home alone with Danielle." And David goes, "Well, why don't you just give me your number, because I host adult parties here at my swimming pool, just so you know." And she says he gives her a super creepy look. So she's like weirded out. She writes down her husband's name and phone number and gives it to him, which is essentially a super nice way of rejecting his advances, not once now, but twice.
Been there.
As this conversation is ending, the sea of media people that are out in the street parts, and David Westerfield pulls up in his RV. It's now the day after Danielle Van Damme has been taken from her bed in the middle of the night, and the media immediately swarms David. The FBI turns on the TV and just watches live as the media talks to him. They're standing in front of David's garage, and just as the news is about to ask their first question, David goes, "Wait, hold on a minute." He goes inside his house and comes back out with a baseball hat on and says, "Does this look good?" Which is like, dude, WTF is wrong with you? Like, you know what I mean? Like, somebody like that is being interviewed about a child abduction and possible murder isn't worried about what they look like. That's a weird thing.
I agree, but you don't want to look bad, though, because you're going to be everywhere. I mean, I can see that. I'm not a fashionista, but I get that.
David Westerfield, fashionista. So two child abduction experts grab him, and they ask him for consent to search his house and RV, and he agrees. He says he drove to the desert and the beach for a total of 300 miles by himself in the last 24 hours. Very weird. Police later find out that he had stopped at a gas station and paid a kid to go in and buy him a newspaper and a snack and grab a receipt, essentially trying to come up with an alibi to prove where he was while this investigation had started going on, because, you know, he wanted to be like, "Oh, well, look, I got this newspaper. See, I was out. I was doing that," you know, whatever. One of the first things that the main FBI profiler says to the other investigators before they walk into this guy's house is Danielle has a dog that sheds. Remember, I told you this dog was going to be important. He goes, "If she was anywhere in this house, there will be dog hair matching this breed. Be looking for dog hair. And looking for it in the house beyond the entryway where her and her mom had been. Remember, they were there for Girl Scout cookies." So when they go in, they see in David's laundry room that there's a huge pile of bedding from his master bedroom that had just been washed and dried. So they take out the dryer vent, and sure enough, there are dog hairs from Danielle's dog. So Danielle's dog literally helps police catch this guy. Animal Planet did an episode on this case for their show. I think it's called Animal Witness, which spotlights animals that actually help solve crimes, which I think is really cool. So this dog is like awesome.
Yeah, they, move over, Air Bud.
Right? They also, Lassie has nothing on this dog.
Exactly.
They also found two empty bottles of bleach and other cleaning supplies. And in the RV, there's a receipt for a laundromat. They go to the laundromat and recover clothes that he had dropped off, which are sheets and a jacket. And on the jacket, they find blood that belongs to Danielle. There's also a handprint from Danielle on the wall next to the bed in the RV. And for weeks, the entire city and law enforcement is searching and searching for Danielle's body. On February 27th, police get a call that a body is found in the desert that was in extreme decomposition. The body belongs to 7-year-old Danielle Van Damme.
Oh, man.
The decomp was actually so bad that they could only identify her by her dental records. And this was really bad because since her body was in this state, they couldn't even prove that a sexual assault had even happened, although it's very safe, obviously, to assume that it did. So this is where this story is so mind-blowing to me, that the details, I just, like, can't believe it. Even crazier is David Westerfield has a patent. Any guesses on what the patent might be on?
I'm going to say like a blood cleaning up thing, like to get rid of DNA.
Good guess. But no, it's the control system for home security systems.
Ooh.
Yeah. which explains why the Van Damme sliding glass door had been left open, but the alarm hadn't gone off. He was able to either hack into it or disable it in some way because he was familiar with it. They also looked on David's computer, and one of the things that the FBI profiler said was that whoever the killer was probably was sexually diverse and attracted to both adults and children, which apparently is a thing. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so, I was going to say, to me, that's not like, hey, guess what? I'm sexually diverse, baby.
Right. I thought that for sure, like, if you were a pedophile or had a thing for kids, you were only into kids. But apparently there are people that are both, which makes them harder to catch. So they look on this guy's computer, and sure enough, he has photos and videos proving that that's true.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, he blames all of his child pornography on a 17-year-old son and says it must have been his. What a POS. One of the creepiest things David had was this anime porn of a creepy guy hiding in the bushes, and a little schoolgirl walks by and he abducts, sexually assaults, and kills her. And the DA ends up using this video in the trial as proof of motive. He maintained his innocence, by the way, in court, despite the fact that there was all this overwhelming evidence against him. In August of 2002, David Westerfield is convicted of kidnapping, child pornography, and first-degree murder. And during the trial, David's 19-year-old niece said that when she was 7, she spent the night at his house and was having a slumber party with his daughter, and that he had come into the room in the middle of the night, and his niece woke up to him rubbing her teeth with his finger. And she said she bit his finger as hard as she could and immediately ran out of the room and told her mom. And that when her mom questioned David, he said he was trying to get into the room to check on them and that she bit him while he was trying to comfort her, and that the whole thing was a mistake. And then the whole thing was just forgotten.
Oh, that's so creepy.
The family never talked about it again.
How do you forget that? Some guy's like,
I don't think people want to believe that their own family could be capable, you know what I mean, of something like that.
I'm sorry, but I think once you have a kid, like, it doesn't matter if they're family or not, like, that's your kid.
Well, not like 90% of kids that are sexually abused, it is almost always someone in their family, their parents, their grandparents, someone close to them. It is hardly ever a stranger. So when you talk to your kids about stranger danger or like inappropriate touching and all that, you need to be talking to them about people that might seem like, you know, someone friendly at school or someone you know or a friend's parent or something. That's who it usually is, a stepdad or whatever. It's not usually a random guy like this. But the creepiest thing, in my opinion, that they found when searching this guy's house was that in the master bedroom, he had a bathroom with a window. And that window had a screen that had an imprint of a man's face in it.
No.
Oh.
The window overlooked Danielle's backyard, and David would press his face into that screen so aggressively and so often to watch Danielle that his face literally left an imprint into the window screen of the exact shape of a man's head.
Ugh.
That is the murder of Danielle Van Damme. You can see photos of her parents, and David Westerfield, her killer, on Instagram at Joan Alex Show. Let us know what you thought was the most interesting part of the case, and we will see you next week for another Murder Monday.
All right, awesome. Thank you so much, Alex. Coming up on the Joe and Alex Show here on Radio Now, we're going to continue our Monday Music Marathon, but we got to talk to producer Porkchop. I guess something really embarrassing happened to you, or is it funny?
Probably both.
Oh, I and love your embarrassing stories.
It involves one of you.
Oh, gosh. Great.
I feel like it involves me, but I could be wrong. We'll find out what it is coming in about 5 or 6 minutes. Don't go anywhere.